Sustaining America's Precision Strike Advantage, the latest work from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, and the authors of the work, Brian Clark and Mark Gunzinger, in studio with me to talk about the work. Brian and Mark, thank you very much for coming in today. Mark, I want to start with you. Define the term precision strike and what its place is in the inventory of weaponry in the United States. Thanks for your time today, both you gentlemen.
Thank you. It's our pleasure. Thank you for having us today. I think most people would think of precision strike in terms of accuracy of weapons, be they gravity-drop weapons, cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, and so forth. Now, when I was a young co-pilot quite a few years ago, a pretty good day was a day where we took off, we flew a training mission, and we had simulated bomb scores of less than 1,000 feet. Now, today, B-52 crews, if you score 1,000 feet, that's not a very good day. They're down to double digits, 10 meters worth on average for a sortie. But it's not just about accuracy. It's about what it can do for us as a nation in terms of our precision strike capabilities. Our platforms, be they aircraft, ships, submarines, or launch precision-guided weapons, are much more capable than individual platforms were before there was precision. So precision-guided weapons are really force multipliers. So in the past, during World War II, where airmen had to use many hundreds of tons of bombs to inflict the kind of damage they wanted on a target, they had to substitute mass for lack of precision. Today, aircraft can attack multiple targets per sortie. So that's a dramatic shift and how we conduct our operations.
Brian, what has that shift meant in the way that we strategize the use of those weapons?
So what we decide now is when we build a plan for conducting a strike operation, we assume that each one of those weapons is going to hit the appropriate target. So it used to be like in World War II, as Gonzo was saying, you would have to go out and drop a lot of weapons on a target area and hope that one of them hit it because the weapons were not very accurate and they were unguided. Today, we assume that each one of the weapons we launch is going to make it to the target. What that does is it significantly reduces the number of strike sorties or aircraft that we have to send on a mission. It also enables us to do strikes from much longer ranges away, because if the weapon can guide itself to the target, I can launch it on a Tomahawk cruise missile from 1,000 miles away, and it'll take itself to the target. I don't have to position the aircraft directly above the target and aim the weapon myself. So the weapon can aim itself. It doesn't need the aircraft to do so. So in terms of our strike planning, we're much more efficient now in being able to allocate platforms that carry weapons to the individual targets they're going to attack. We've reduced our strike platforms than it was result.
Do we enjoy a cost dividend from that, or has the complexity of the weaponry sucked up the advantage that we might gain from that?
No, we've enjoyed a tremendous cost dividend, if you will. The fact that we now had precision weapons on our strike platforms was part of the rationale back during the bottom-up review in 1993 for reducing the size of our air forces, for our Navy, our fleet, that matter. And that was great as long as, frankly, the enemies that we were fighting did not have countermeasures against our precision strike capabilities. Mm-hmm. That has changed, and that's why we wrote this report. The fact is, not only do our future enemies will likely have their own precision-guided weapons to attack our bases and our staging areas and our ships at sea, but they will have precision defenses against our platforms and our PGMs after they are launched. Because precision guidance technologies advantages both the offense and the defense. And if we no longer have 100% assurance or a high probability that individual weapons will actually arrive at their targets, now we're talking about revisiting the past, where we might have to use lots of precision-guided weapons to ensure individual targets are attacked or destroyed. We achieve the effects we want on them. We don't have the weapons to do that, and we don't have the platforms to do that.
You write in this work about the historic two-war planning construct that has been the basis for policymaking and strategy preparation at the Pentagon up until the 2014 Quadrennial Defense Review. Give me a summary, Brian, of how that plan, how that strategy concept changed in the QDR in 2014.
Well, our original strategy, or the strategy we'd had for a long time since the end of the Cold War, was that we need to be able to fight two medium-sized conflicts, if you will, simultaneously. So like a war with Iran and a war with North Korea or something like that, so that we could have enough forces so that if one country started a war, the other would not be able to assume that they could take that opportunity to attack our allies and get away with it. Mm-hmm. Well, in the 2014 QDR, in recognition of the budget reductions that were imposed by the Budget Control Act, the department had to rethink that because that required a large enough force that we couldn't afford anymore. So they shifted the strategy slightly to now say that we need to be able to conduct one relatively large operation, like a war with Iran or Korea, but at the same time need to be able to delay or thwart the efforts of an opportunistic aggressor in another theater, meaning we wouldn't necessarily be able to win a war with that second aggressor, but we would be able to hold them off long enough so that we could shift forces and with our allies be able to mount a counteroffensive that would then, you know, push them back.
A retired uniformed leader told me, Mark, framed it this way: we've gone from fighting with both hands to fighting with one hand and holding the other guy off with the other hand. Is that a fair way to
Well, that was something that was actually addressed during the 1993 bottom-up review. Maybe we should go to win, hold, win, where we would win one conflict defined by could be a decisive defeat and even an occupation of an enemy's territory, mm-hmm. And hold on the other conflict in a different geographic area so the enemy does not gain the advantage on us. But when we're done decisively defeating in the first region, we can then swing our forces over to the second and inflict a decisive defeat over there, mm-hmm. if it need be. I see echoes of what we're doing today in that. They're not calling it win, hold, win. It's more win in one and spoil the attack of another, and if necessary, swing to conduct a larger scale operation there. But the point for our report is that could still require two precision strike operations, mm-hmm. a fairly large scale.
So Brian laid out the explanation of what happened in that transition from one strategy position to the other. You call that in this report troubling. Why is that troubling, that shift, and what's the implication? You touched on it there just a moment ago, but what's the implication for precision strike?
What is troubling is that we have optimized our force structure to include our PGM inventory to fight one particular kind of war. Mm-hmm. And that is against opponents that don't have precision defenses, where we have, frankly, assured access to bases, the ability to refuel on the border of an enemy, if not in enemy airspace, fly our strike aircraft and other platforms very close to the targets. And we have shrunk our force structure to be able to do that. The problem is, if all those assumptions are changing, we can no longer stage from bases very close to an enemy. We can't do that close in air refueling. And our aircraft and ships will be attacked by precision guided weapons. Well, that's very troubling. We've sized for one fight, but we might have to engage in a very different kind of fight. And that goes to our precision guided weapons, too.
Brian, you write in this report that you use a salvo competition framework. What does that mean, and how does it apply to the subject matter?
Well, it used to be in the last 20 years or so that precision-guided weapons were owned by the United States and its allies only. Our potential adversaries didn't have them, so we had a unilateral advantage there. Well, what's happening now is precision-guided weapons are accruing to our potential adversaries as well as these technologies proliferate. So surface-to-air missiles, electronic warfare systems, the kinds of precision defenses that we've usually planned on using are now being made available to potential adversaries like China and Iran and North Korea. What we're going to encounter then is as we go in and try and do precision strike operations, our salvos of precision strike weapons are going to be attrited by these precision defenses that the enemy can bring to bear. And that means that we need to bring larger salvos to bear or more survivable salvos to bear so that we can overcome that defensive capacity that the enemy is able to mount. And so you end up with this salvo competition where it's offense versus defense on both sides, and both sides have precision weapons both in their offensive systems and their defensive systems. And the key to being able to win is to be able to mount an offensive capacity that exceeds the defensive capacity of your adversary.
You write in this paper about new operational concepts. This is my favorite part because you're rethinking what we're doing now as opposed to just we need more of this and or less of that. You write here that that you're concluding simply using more current generation PGMs to compensate for an enemy's precision strike defenses would be prohibitively costly. Is that necessarily the best outcome, or are the outcomes that you're suggesting better as well as being cheaper?
One of the problems is we can't simply throw money at these kinds of challenges. We can't afford to buy enough new platforms and additional munitions, the kind we have today, to counter what we see our competitors doing to thwart our precision strike operations. We're saying, let's be smart about this. Let's ask if we have the right operational concepts for strike. Let me give you an example.
Sure.
One of them is about how we go about shaping our PGM mix. Today, 96% of the PGMs we've bought are pretty much direct attack weapons. In fact, since 2001, we did analysis of it in a report, 96% are direct attack weapons. And by that, I mean they're weapons that have a range of 15 nautical miles or less after release from an aircraft. That requires an aircraft to get pretty close to a target. And if those targets are not defended, like we frankly haven't been in over the last 25 years, not a problem. In the future, and today, there are scenarios where those targets will be heavily defended. Mm-hmm. And our aircraft won't be able to get that close. So even our stealthiest aircraft against advanced integrated air defense systems are going to need more standoff. So shifting away from direct attack operations toward more standoff operations will increase the survivability of our platforms. And if our platforms can't survive the release of weapons, again, we have a problem.
You have a number of possible approaches that you write about: tunneling operations, collaborative weapons operations, an emphasis on long-range strike ops, different uses for short-range aircraft, new basing approaches, and a shift from direct attacks to short-range standoff strike operations. Brian, are there any of these that we're doing now or doing effectively now or maybe doing not enough of that a significant change would make a difference, or are these all pretty new concepts?
Some of those are things we do today to some degree. So, for example, one of the concepts talks about shifting more of our strike operations to be from longer range, because if we can do our strike operations from more than 2,500 nautical miles away from the enemy, we'll largely be immune from his attack. So it'll keep the airbase in operation more. We can generate more strike sorties, and more weapons can get on the target. So we can do that today, and we do it to some degree, but right now a lot of our aircraft are designed for short-range strike operations. So the strike fighters that we have today are mostly about 600 to 700 nautical miles in range, which means they're well within the envelope of enemy attacks, which means the bases from which they operate are going to be subject to periodic and large attacks from the enemy. They'll be reducing the number of sorties they can generate. So shifting most of our strike operations to longer range would give us more weapons on the target, and that's one of the key things in the salvo competition is, can I get more weapons per salvo, and can I make those salvos more survivable? Mm-hmm. Another concept that we do today to some degree, but we could do a lot more in the future, is collaborative weapon operations. As the enemy's defenses get better, I'm going to have to launch more and more weapons at each individual target in order to make sure one of them gets through, because they're going to get shot at by electronic warfare systems and surface-to-air missiles and everything. So if I'm able to have my weapons talk to each other and coordinate with one another so that if all the weapons going to a target were destroyed by the air defenses, weapons from some other target that are in excess can be shifted over and sent to that target so I can efficiently allocate my weapons, and it reduces the number that I have to launch and makes it more effective as a strike operation. Today, we can do that to some degree because Tomahawk weapons, for example, and JASMs have data links, and we could steer them and reallocate them in flight. But in the future, we're going to need that much more quickly. And we're going to need to do it in an environment that's probably the communications are going to be contested. So we may not have the ability to talk to our weapons, and we may depend on them to talk to each other. And that requires some new technologies that are in development and mature. They just haven't been fielded very much yet. So there's a couple of concepts there that we could pursue today to a greater degree, and then new technologies would facilitate them.
And in addition to shifting to more standoff range, we need obviously the munitions to allow our platforms to do that. Another concept that we frankly don't do today, and we don't have the capacity to do, is what we call tunneling operations, where the leading edge of a wave of precision-guided munitions might be really cheap, dumb munitions. They're headed in the direction. The enemy has to react to those weapons. They have to counter them because they don't know if they're real or not. Mm-hmm. So force the enemy to waste his great defenses on our cheap weapons and then follow them with our good weapons to hit the target. It'll essentially increase the survivability of our PGM salvos.
And when you say the term cheap weapons, in my own mind, between the lines, I read we can buy more of them and continue to pound those targets to soften them up. Am I on the right track?
And another thing we find is when we did the analysis for the report is cheap weapons tend to be smaller weapons, and they tend to be therefore carried in larger numbers per sortie, which gets you back into the salvo competition of being able to mount a larger salvo. So one thing we looked at in the study is the range of weapons we need to be pursuing is about in the 100 to 400 nautical mile range, because today our weapons mix is predominantly very short range weapons that Mark was talking about, and then very long range weapons like Tomahawk and the Calcum, which are very large as a result of their range. So I can carry a very small number of Tomahawks or Calcums, or I can carry a much larger number of very small gravity weapons. But unfortunately, my platforms are not survivable enough to use those gravity weapons, and they can carry a too small a salvo of the long-range weapons. So we need something in between, and we've got a big gap right now in the 100 to 400 nautical mile range.
When you go about doing a work like this, gentlemen, how do you consider anticipating potential advances by our adversaries to counter some of the things that you're suggesting so that 2 to 5 years after a strategy like this would be deployed, we're not back at the same point again?
Well, that's an excellent question. What we typically do and did for this project is we went out and we talked to the labs, we talked to industry, we talked to DoD, the best sources we could. And the fact of the matter is, in this competition, the salvo competition, and other competitions like stealth, counter-stealth, advances in information technology, precision guidance technologies, unmanned technologies, autonomous technologies accrue to both sides. And the key is, can we get it in the field quicker than our competitors? Can we develop the technologies, operationalize them, put them on our weapon systems, and keep an advantage? Because it really is a competition. It really is cyclical. Because we know that once we deploy an advantage, that's good for a period of time, and our competitors will find a way of countering that. So we need the advantage that'll follow that.
And so then we turn to all of the conversations that I have on this program on an ongoing basis about the procurement system inside the Pentagon and cybersecurity, about protecting the intellectual property of the government and the contractors who are providing this type of weapon system and all of those kinds of things. It strikes me that no matter how well thought out and planned the strategy is, we kind of come back to the same nuts and bolts issues no matter what subject it is we start on.
Right. So one thing we looked at in here is we assumed that the technologies we describe in the paper, like hypersonic weapons and weapons with data links and very expensive seekers, those are going to accrue to both sides. We assume that we will not have a technological advantage necessarily in this competition. And that's why we focused on things that are going to not be dependent upon technology. So the idea of making larger salvos of smaller weapons, the idea of making our weapons salvos more survivable, those apply even if the adversary starts to come up with better and better defenses. We're going to do another report that talks about defensive systems, where we look at the other side of this as well, is how can the United States improve its own defensive systems to make the problem harder for the enemy on the offensive side. So that, again, this competition is going to play out, but we tried to focus on things that were less sensitive to a particular technology being developed by us and then advanced, because we felt like they were going to accrue to both sides.
That said, there are technologies that we can field in, well, within the next 5 to 10 years, certainly like hypersonic weapons, brilliant submunitions, which will give each PGM the capability of striking multiple targets per weapon, not per aircraft, but per weapon. We can field that. We have the technology to do that, but there isn't the funding, there isn't the program to put those capabilities in the hands of our warfighters. We could have a technological edge over our enemies and some of these capabilities you suggest in the report if those programs were funded.
One other thing we looked at is to get to this acquisition challenge that you describe and that you've talked about several times in the program, is we looked a lot at weapons that we could make by modifying existing weapons. So several of our current weapons that are direct attack weapons could be modified with a small engine to turn them into a standoff weapon that falls into this 100 to 400 mile range that we described. And that would not be very expensive. It would be a modification to an existing system, so it wouldn't require a new start acquisition program. And it would give you the kind of weapon you need that's relatively small, relatively inexpensive, and has enough standoff range for the platform that delivers it to be survivable. So we looked at modifications to existing weapons. Another way we looked at this is also families of weapons. The Navy's standard missile series they use for air defense, well, those also have a surface attack mode that's available to them, and the Navy's looking to incorporate that into their doctrine, into their procedures, as well as incorporate that feature into the future generations of those weapons, for example, the SM-6. The other weapons that we looked at this for are JASSM. So they're looking at also making that the basis for the long-range anti-ship missile, the LRASM. So families of weapons would also help you get around these acquisition challenges and give you the ability for each weapons stow or each weapons pylon to be able to perform multiple missions instead of just one mission.
The key point here is we see folks making, I think, a mistake when they say, here's some cool technology, we ought to buy it. That's not what we're saying. We're saying, first, let's take a look at how we can change our operational concepts, how we prefer to conduct operations. Then let's see what we can do to modify weapons we have and maybe do it at much less cost. And finally, there are some technologies that are mature we can invest in to produce new weapons.
That maintain our. That's advantage. A novel concept. Figure out what capability you need and then figure out how to get that capability. And that kind of leads me to the final question, which is, what are the potential game changers here? Not necessarily, as you said, Mark, what the sexiest technology that could come down the road. If only we could get that, everything would be great. But conceptually, the good game changers, if we're the ones that are able to introduce them, or the bad ones, if our adversaries were to gain them.
Yeah, I'll talk about directed energy. And we talk about it in the report. Most people think in terms of directed energy being lasers and perhaps high-power microwave weapons and electric weapons more broadly, railguns. But they think about it in terms of defensive capabilities, not offensive. You know, if we have fighters, bombers, tankers, tanker aircraft for that matter, unmanned aircraft with high-power lasers, if they have 150-plus kilowatt lasers on board, that'll give them some very significant capabilities against air-to-air weapons that would be used to try to shoot them down, service-to-air weapons, and even other aircraft and ground targets. That, I think, could be a real game-changer, as well as PGMs that, like cruise missiles that carry high-power microwave generators that can attack scores of targets per weapon. So we're talking real game-changing territory here if we field it.
And cheap, too. I had Peter Morrison from the Office of Naval Research on the program back in the spring, and his office is developing a laser that's $1 a shot. I mean, it's real. So that's exactly the kind of game changer I'm talking about.
Electronic warfare and electronic warfare being used on decoys that are weapon-sized, or electronic warfare systems, little jammers being put on weapons themselves, might be a dramatic game changer. It's not very expensive, and it's existing technology, but would enable individual weapons to be more survivable and increase the probability that they will arrive at the target. And so that would be a game changer when it comes to this salvo competition.
I lied when I said that last question was the last question. This is the last question. What's the path to implementing what you gentlemen are proposing in this work?
Well, I think that the third offset strategy work that's underway now in the department is the perfect venue to take a look at some of the concepts and capabilities that we're suggesting are mature enough to be funded as actual programs, which will lead to acquisition of these capabilities. So I think it's the perfect venue and the perfect time to do it as we consider what is it that we ought to do to change the way we operate, to change the technologies we invest in, to change our future force structure for the future, because we're not going to necessarily fight in the future as we have in the past. And our force structure and our capabilities are pretty much optimized to fight as we have in the past.
Brian, final thoughts?
Well, the initiative that Secretary Work has going on with regard to wargaming and the Defense Innovation Initiative would be a great place to leverage for these kind of capabilities to be fielded, because they could look at new operational concepts in the context of war games, look at how the implications of those for the kinds of programs we would need, and then start maybe shifting the program of record to start including some of these modifications to weapons that would make them more useful in a salvo competition.
I want to congratulate both of you on this work. We are going to link to the report and the slide deck at which from the rollout event at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and I'm grateful for a terrific conversation about it. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Francis.